The whole first impeachment was about the run-up to interference.
Yeah, the impeachment of Trump was for him denying Ukraine weapons.
Right.
He would send them as long as Zelensky helped him look into Hunter Biden.
Right. So, I mean, the weapons started going, and the U.S. actually did change after 2014 under Obama. Yeah.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast.
Ron Kelch is a longtime Marxist humanist philosopher and activist. He is the author of numerous articles, bringing out ideas, animating the many movements in which he participates, as well as engaging Marx's original recreation of Hegel's ideas, or idea. Ursula Wieslanka is a longtime Marxist humanist, kicked out of Poland for the crime of having a Jewish father, a feminist and activist, a writer particularly on East European movements, and most recently prisoners' rights movements. Both Ursula and Ron are members of the News and Letters Committee. Just to begin with, before we dive into the topic, which is Israel's war and Hamas attack stoke regression, that's the name of the article. Before we talk about that, remind people what News and Letters is.
What shaped the creation of News and Letters? The News and Letters organization emerged out of Trotskyism and the New Left. Specifically, it emerged after Roya Doyenskaya split with CLR James. Actually, let's step back and walk through the splits that led to News and Letters. Roya Doyenskaya was originally a member of the SWP, the Socialist Workers' Party, which was the Trotskyist organization that consisted of the most committed core of the Workers' Party of the United States. The SWP was what was left over after the Workers' Party merged with the Socialist Party of America, an organization that had been formed in 1901 and consisted of figures such as Eugene Debs, Walter Lippmann, and Julius Wayland, amongst others. In 1940, the SWP itself went through a split, and Roya Doyenskaya was a key player in that split. The party split over disputes about the internal government of the party, disputes about the class nature of the USSR, and differences in understanding Marxism and philosophy. The Workers' Party emerged from this split. The Workers' Party consisted of Max Chatman, CLR James, Roya Doyenskaya, and many others. Doyenskaya eventually split with the Workers' Party and formed the Forrest Johnson tendency with CLR James, only to split with him and the by-then renamed Forrest Johnson tendency. They'd renamed themselves the Correspondence Publishing Committee. By some accounts, this split occurred over a difference in interpreting the last three paragraphs of Hegel's Science of Logic. And here are those paragraphs. The idea, namely in positing itself as absolute unity of the pure notion and its reality, and thus contracting itself into the immediacy of being, is a totality in this form, nature. But this determination has not issued from a process of becoming, nor is it a transition, as when above, the subjective notion in its totality becomes objectivity, and the subjective end becomes life. On the contrary, the pure idea in which the determinateness or reality of the notion is itself raised into notion is an absolute liberation for which there is no longer any immediate determination that is not equally posited and itself notion. In this freedom, therefore, no transition takes place. The simple being to which the idea determines itself remains perfectly transparent to it and is the notion that, in its determination, abides with itself. The passage is therefore to be understood here rather in this manner, that the idea freely releases itself in its absolute self-assurance and inner poise. By reason of this freedom, the form of its determinateness is also utterly free. The externality of space and time existing absolutely on its own account, without the moment of subjectivity. Insofar as this externality presents itself only in the abstract immediacy of being and is apprehended from the standpoint of consciousness, it exists as mere objectivity and external life. But in the idea, it remains essentially and actually in and for itself, the totality of the notion, and science and the relationship to nature of divine cognition. But in this next resolve of the pure idea to determine itself as external idea, it thereby only posits for itself the mediation out of which the notion ascends as a free existence that has withdrawn into itself from externality, that completes its self-liberation in the science of spirit, and that finds the supreme notion of itself in the science of logic as the self-comprehending pure notion. Just how these paragraphs were interpreted and where and how the disagreement emerged is a question that I'll leave unanswered. But Raya is thought to have had a philosophical breakthrough, and she believed that the absolute idea should be conceived of as a new society.
Well, News and Letters Committees is an organization established in early 50s. As partly a response to McCarthyism in the United States, but mostly to try to really develop Marx's original insights, and has a very different take on Marx, stressing not labor theory of value, but the humanism, what Marx called thoroughgoing naturalism or humanism, which is based on recreating Hegel's idea reality and thought are not two separate pillars the way Kant's philosophy projected it, but are stem from one stem, which is life. So everything starts with life. And for Marx, that was the starting point. And that was the continuity and discontinuity with Hegel.
So this article from the News and Letters Committees, which is a Marxist humanist organization, is entitled, again, Israel's War and Hamas Attack Stoke Retrogression. I think if you were to be critical of it, someone was trying to criticize it, some people on the left might say that the News and Letters Committees is trying to have it both ways. There's a tendency to want to insist upon the Marxists or socialists or leftists of any stripe having to take a side in the conflict. Pick whether you support Israel or you support Hamas. How did News and Letters come to a position and to understand that it was possible not to do either thing?
Well, we've had those discussions with some people, and one of our friends said he is always supporting resistance, and resistance always has to be supported. And I certainly agree that resistance has to be supported when it is resistance with a vision of what they're fighting for beyond just saying no to what is. Hamas is a very retrogressive resistance. It is resistance, but it is it's just the other side of the coin of Netanyahu. They both arose together as opposing forces within the region, and they both feed off of each other. There's absolutely no question in my mind that what Hamas is for has nothing to do with freedom. And in fact, they do not honor Palestinian lives. We already know they don't honor Jewish lives, but they don't even care about Palestinian lives. So as we said before, if you start with life, neither side is for life.
Brian, did you want to add to that?
Well, I agree with what Ashura was saying. I think what we're seeing here is kind of a death spiral that is part of the global retrogression of going into the deepest, most unfathomable depths of turning the other into something that's an animal and worth just killing, dehumanizing the other. The language and everything about these actions and ideas that are personified by the actors in this say that. Now, with that said, this is not to say that the opposition to Israel and the horror that Israel is committing in response is in any way justified or it's just so much a part of the permanence of this death spiral that the whole world, the world without beginning with life like we started, the world is devolving into this fascism and permanent war, and the Israel Hamas or Netanyahu Hamas are sucking all the oxygen out of any kind of pointers that are leading out of this, that begin from life, that begin from human beings asserting their freedom within their life activity and asserting their reciprocal right to be recognized as living beings, asserting their right to be free in their life activity. And that's Marx's foundation, and that's what needs to be brought forward.
What would you say to, well, first of all, it's worth noting that in your piece, or in the News and Letters piece written by Franklin Dimitriev, I believe is how that said, there's some time spent outlining or summarizing the inhumanity of the Israeli state and the genocidal intention of Netanyahu's IDF and the siege and bombardment. People are quoted to demonstrate the intent, the number of casualties is listed, and it has to be updated every day, I think now. So it is very clear from reading this that there's no support or love of Benjamin Netanyahu's Israel in the piece. What would you say to critics of Israel or Palestinians who are seeking liberation from the Israeli occupation, who would claim that Israel from its beginning was a settler colonial project, that it that the Israel as a state doesn't have a right to exist given its settler colonial nature, and that therefore some other state should be founded, a Palestinian one, perhaps, where Israel is now? What would you, how would you respond to that?
Well, I don't agree with how the Israeli state was founded, but I don't buy that analogy. I don't accept that as the grounding of any of this, because the Jews didn't exactly have any alternative in a world of states where they just got massacred in a genocidal, unfathomable event. And many of the Jews that settled Israel came from the Arab world in the first place, where they weren't exactly treated as human beings. And the Jews are indigenous to the area. I mean, Marx even wrote about the poor Jews in Jerusalem. And so I don't have that view, but I think you can't forget the context of the displacement of 700,000 Palestinians in that original event. And you can't run away from the details and the context for all this. You have to face all the facts of it. And the Arabs at the time were telling the Arab countries around Israel, around the founding of Israel, telling the Palestinians to leave. Mm-hmm. And the ones who stayed, you know, some of them did stay. And not that they have a great life, but it wasn't exactly the same as what's unfolded. So I don't agree with the general perspective on, you know, just saying this is like a settler colonialism the way Fanon talked about it, or the way Fanon even talked about resistance was always the question of asserting one's humanity and against all the tendencies in the movement that fell into pitfalls of narrow nationalism and looking to the past and looking to theocracy. Fanon has this beautiful letter warning people who are taking his philosophy that the Islamists who are kind of like liberation theology Islamists, saying, you know, this is not the way to go. You don't look to the past. You have to go through this. And it's this assertion of one's humanity is so critical, a dimension of what liberation is about. And one cannot truncate that vision as a leftist, as a progressive, as someone who wants a new human world.
So a big part of this essay is, you know, in the title there, the word retrogression.
Yes.
What do you mean? What does mean by the word retrogression? Is it different than regression? And what is the cause of this retrogression?
Well, I think that what's cited there about mindless terrorism, you know, mindless, just
kill,
because these are people, no matter what, need to be killed. Women, children, rape the women and burn their bodies, you know, all the horrors that have come out about it. And Netanyahu and the settler terrorism doesn't destroy the system, doesn't challenge the systems. It opens the door to repression. Because nothing united the Jews, all the Israelis, more than this event, again, you know, in a way that wasn't at all an opening to something, anything new. There's a lot of Arab and Jewish groups that want to start with recognizing the humanity of the other. And all that has been
swept away,
put on the back burner by this moment. In fact, the places that they chose to attack and say, just kill and do what you want, were some of the most anti-occupation Israelis in Israel.
So when you speak of retrogression, you mean abandonment of one's humanity and respect for life. I guess what I'm wondering is if you think this retrogression is intensifying, and if so, is it primarily intensifying just in Israel and Palestine, or you do mention that the Western left seems to be suffering from a retrogression as well. What failures, I guess, in the struggle for humanity and for life and for Marxism have led us to this retrogression, do you think?
Well, I think I sort of started with this when he's saying Marxist humanism, and Marxist humanism especially, is about not ever letting what you're against define one. It's what one is for. And that's the Marx's opposition to vulgar communism and even pure atheism, if you let what you're against define you, you fall into becoming what you're against on some level. And it's Marx's foundation in his idea of freedom in life, in free conscious life activity, that sets him apart. And it's an idea that he embellishes and develops in his whole body of thought. So I don't know if that is a...
No, that's fine. I guess I want to explore that a bit more. I guess the way to... That's a way into discussing the broad Western left's response to the attacks of October 7th and the war and the bombardment within Gaza. I've noted that on October 7th, or some on the left were celebrating the attacks. I saw a well-known U.S. Marxist, an academic, you know, proclaimed that this was a great moment in of defeat for Israel, and throw out the slogan "From the River to the Sea" on October 7th. I saw others who were critical of the left, not other leftists, claim that the far left's response to October 7th was discrediting, and that they were making themselves into non-entities in U.S. politics in that moment. So I'm interested to know how you think the Western left has ended up in this position where the inhumanity of Hamas is something they feel they can't critique. I've asked you that question one way. I'm asking it another way now. Ursula, you haven't said much in a little bit. Do you want to try to answer that?
Well, unfortunately, what I see on a lot of the left, including our friend I mentioned before, who had never heard of retrogressive resistance, they are caught up in what they are opposed. Right. So it's very right to be opposed to U.S. imperialism. It's very right to be opposed to a lot of things, apartheid, military-industrial complex, all kinds of things that we are opposed to. But what is it that we are for is what determines what our opposition, where it's leading. So Steve Bannon is calling himself a revolutionary.
A Leninist,
right? So is that what we're for, Steve Bannon? There is quite a bit of left that is actually calling for a red-brown alliance. It's shocking to me, actually shocking to me, that this is how much the left has devolved in their just knee-jerk opposition to what is, to not even pay any attention to what they're for.
Well, one of the difficulties today is how both the terms red and brown are defined. While I, you know, think that Steve Bannon, for instance, is a reactionary who I wouldn't want to embrace, I'm not sure if I would call him outright brown fascist. You know, and it seems to me that. Others who are not anywhere near Steve Bannon politically have been kind of cast aside as right-wing, reactionary, conservative when they're simply willing to be critics of the Democratic Party right now. Like, for instance, someone like a journalist like Glenn Greenwald gets called right-wing quite a lot. So it's difficult to know how to avoid reaction in this moment. And I'll give you an example. And this is way off to the side of Israel-Palestine. But yesterday, a Colorado Supreme Court, decided that Trump was an insurrectionary and couldn't and would not be appearing on the Colorado ballot during the primaries. You know, he was not going to be allowed to be a candidate for the nomination in the Republican Party. And this was done despite the fact that Trump has not been charged with insurrection. And so without any real due process. And it also seemed to be done as a political maneuver for the Democratic Party. So I would be inclined to oppose that Supreme Court decision based on wanting to uphold the due process and oppose lawfare. But on the other hand, if we think Donald Trump is a brown fascist, then perhaps it is worthwhile in a state of emergency to allow the Colorado Supreme Court to break the fundamental rules of the Republic in order to protect the country from Trump. So I wonder, what did you think of the Supreme Court decision in Colorado?
Well, I don't think that's a determinant of any of this, but I'm looking at it with fascination. You know, in other words, the constitutionalism is up in a bind because of all their strict construction, as their textualism and all this stuff. They would have to kick him off. You know, the evidence is overwhelming that the guy wanted to destroy democracy, and he wants another chance at democracy to destroy democracy.
Welcome to the News Hour. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that the 14th Amendment does not allow individual states to remove former President Donald Trump from their ballots.
In an unsigned opinion, the court said only that Congress, not states, can disqualify presidential candidates under the Constitution's so-called insurrection clause. The former president celebrated the decision.
Essentially, you cannot take somebody out of a race because an opponent would like to have it that way. And it has nothing to do with the fact that it's the leading candidate, whether it was the leading candidate or a candidate that was well down on the totem pole, you cannot take somebody out of a race.
And William Brangham joins us now. So William, the court was unequivocal. States do not have the power to remove federal candidates from the ballot under the insurrection clause. Help us understand how the justices arrived at this ruling.
They basically said you cannot have a system where a lot of different states are making this decision because it would simply be a sort of ad hoc state by state basis. In their ruling, they said, for the reasons given, responsibility for enforcing Section 3 against federal officeholders and candidates rests with Congress and not the states. The judgment of the Colorado Supreme Court, therefore, cannot stand. It said states can choose to withhold and withdraw state candidates, not federal candidates.
What do you make of the fact that so many young people and I think a good portion of Muslim Americans, or at least there's some organization of Muslim Americans, are turning against Biden at this point over the Israel-Palestine issue, and that could consequently, if Trump can be on the ballot, end up helping usher Trump back into the White House?
Yeah, that's part of the retrogression. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's part of the you know, Biden doesn't I was just almost puked when he started questioning the number of deaths, you know, early on, apologizing for this. But if there is a force in the world that's going to constrain Israel, it's the U.S., but it's not from any kind of human point perspective. I mean, after all, they were going to extend the Abraham Accords and make nice with the Saudis, you know, that who chop up journalists when they oppose them. Americans, the journalists, mm-hmm. You know.
And so you think that Israel and Saudi Arabia normalizing relationships should be opposed then on those grounds?
It's part of the retrogression.
Yeah, it's part of the retrogression.
Retrogressive states recognizing each other and their mutual interests against any ideas of genuine liberation.
Mm-hmm. So when things are, if I may, when things are in such a flux, you don't know who's going to align with who. In other words, that's what we're starting off about, what's unique about Marxist humanism. Right up to when the shooting starts full blown, you know, everybody's betraying everybody. You know, Hitler and Stalin made a pact and so forth. So you don't know. So right now, there, all these alliances were changing in the Middle East. So the Kutniks were saying, to hell with you, Putin, you know, that you betrayed us. And the Hamas jumped in because they saw, you know, once again, the Palestinians were going to be completely left out of the discussion.
Mm-hmm. I had a guest on this week who is not a leftist. He's a American writer and a former vet from Afghanistan. He was a military intelligence in Afghanistan. He's a critic of the intelligence community now due to that experience. He thought the war in Afghanistan was a disaster. And he's living in Israel now. He's an expatriate in Israel. And he calls himself a Zionist, critic of Netanyahu, opposed the indiscriminate bombing in Gaza. But claimed both that the only path towards peace would be not to try to defeat Hamas, but to destroy Hamas. And that's a military distinction. Destroying Hamas means to inflict enough damage on Hamas so that they are no longer able to fight. Whereas defeating Hamas would mean completely removing them from the stage of history, like to make them so they couldn't organize again, they wouldn't be an ideological tendency, they would have no credibility, the population would turn against them. That's defeating them. And he doesn't think that was possible, but he did think destroying their ability to fight was possible. And he also thought that the Abraham Accords would be a way for Israel to break free of U.S. imperialism, because Israel was a client state of the United States and didn't have true independence, and could conceivably lead to a peaceful resolution with the Palestinians if there was enough normalization with Israel so that there would be more security in the region. What do you make of all of that?
That was a mouthful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting, perspective, but you know, to call Israel a client state, you know, when you saw Netanyahu coming over and telling off Obama, say, you know, telling him he's lecturing. Lecturing him for an hour or something, and people were in this country were shocked, who's the client and who's the state, you know? And that's where Netanyahu was thumbing his nose at U.S. imperialism, saying, you know, we have the reactionaries in your country. They're never going to turn against us because we got the Christian right that is hoping for Israel to stay there because that's part of their apocalyptic vision of how everything ends. And we got the Christian right, and we got our own deals with Russia and everybody else. You know, that was part of that. That was part of the showing the weakness of anything of U.S. imperialism right there, coming from the extreme right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's oversimplification from his point of view, you know, and I don't, you know, I certainly don't agree with the kind of characterization of that. By the way, I wanted to know if you saw in Haaretz, if you saw Zizek's piece.
No, I think I may have missed that particular one. I did interview him about the conflict.
Yeah, it's a really a very good piece, you know, as far as it goes. I don't agree with Zizek philosophically, but it was a very good piece. He was being called by Israeli leftists who were...
Oh, wait, was this about his appearance at the book fair? And
yes, his appearance at the book fair, and he had a really long and actually a pretty coherent and well-researched answer, you know, to all these charges. Mm-hmm. And just saying that he doesn't buy the settler perspective on Israel, but he didn't buy what they were accusing him of, which was to make a big distinction between the horror of what Hamas did, that is playing over and over again in Israel, the tapes of this mm-hmm. rape and murder and burning the bodies and killing children and old people and just wanton death. And that he couldn't make a distinction between that and what Israel is doing. And he went into that's too fine a distinction and why. And what the kind of stuff that our article goes into, that this is from the river to the sea, is the vision of the fascists on both sides and their perspective on the future that feeds on each other. And the only thing this is going to end up with is war and more war. And I thought it was a good piece.
I did talk to him about it recently on the channel. I'll send you a link to it. I thought it was a good piece as well. And he told me at the end of the interview that he and I were comrades, that we didn't believe the same exact things about everything, but we fundamentally agreed. So I was glad for that, as a hero of mine. I want to ask about the way in which allegations are leveled during warfare, but by both Israel and Hamas, and the way in which allegations are rejected during times of war. So what I've noticed is that, just as a couple of examples, there were stories after October 7th of babies being beheaded and mass rape. And then the Israeli government walked back the allegations of beheadings of infants, and the allegations of mass rape have been questioned. I see on Twitter, on my and Left Spaces, a lot of people are saying that like someone like George Galloway is tweeting out, you know, that the allegations of mass rape were a complete fabrication of the Israeli government. On the other side of it, you know, though there are tendencies to, on the Israeli side, to blame Hamas for instance, there was a hospital that was bombed, 500 people were killed, and Israel claimed that it was actually a Hamas missile. I don't know what the final story was, but from what I saw, it was certainly not clear that it was not an Israeli bomb that destroyed the hospital. How important do you think it is to get all of the allegations right, to make sure they're verified and validated? And what do you make of the tendency? And I'll just ask you that first question first, and I'll follow it up. So what do you think, how important is it to know what the level of rape was, or whether or not babies were beheaded or not, or how many babies were killed?
Well, I think it's important to get the facts and for in-person reports that you can trust. I mean, I saw the report of the first doctor that showed up on the scene and the women he talked to. You should make the best judgment one can on that basis.
So what do you agree with that, basically, that Because I just think of the fog of war making those kinds of determinations and judgments very, very difficult. And I know that in the United States, when someone's accused of a crime, you know, we go out of our way to provide due process and go through a process of gathering evidence and testing the evidence. And so in a context of war, it seems like the propaganda on both sides is flowing freely, and that I just I'm not capable of keeping up well enough to know which allegations are absolutely true and which ones aren't. But maybe I'm being remiss in my obligations here. But, so what do you think?
Well, I grew up in a totalitarian country. Everyone knew that whatever the government press, because there was only government press, said was a lie. There was absolutely no question about it. And the population in general, including my family, had learned how to read between the lines. So if the government is accusing someone of being a hoodlum, they probably did something that you wanted to support. You learn to read what they're saying and hear the opposite of what they're saying in their very statement. Or here's or if they cut off communication with Gdańsk, for example, there is something going on in Gdańsk that you want to know about. This is the reality of a totalitarian country in which the only source of information pretty much is propaganda. And this is something that I feel Americans don't quite know how to do. Maybe because press here has more credibility. There is still a little more freedom of the press. You can have opinions that dissent. And that's providing some more naivete. It keeps shocking me that the leftists will repeat Putin's statements as though they were fact. It's just unbelievable to me that you wouldn't be able to see how much of it is propaganda. So my approach is to say any act of inhumanity is despicable. It doesn't matter whether the rapes were systematic and provoked or ordered by the leaders, or whether they were just happening. They are wrong. Whether the killing was something that, you know, just do what you will, or whether it was just a spontaneous act of revenge. Killing specifically people who are trying for peace, are opposing their own government to help the Palestinians, killing specifically those people is wrong. And that's not disputable. That's who they went for. And the Israelis on their side went for bombing exactly the refugee camp that had most of the opposition to Hamas.
Yeah.
So the other side is just as guilty of trying to suppress any statement of humanity coming from their own side. Mm-hmm. And that's what has to speak louder than the atrocities being committed.
I want to ask about what you think the path forward might be in Israel and Palestine. What is the hope of News and Letters, and what is your hope for a resolution to the conflict and an end to the occupation, and how would that come about, do you think?
Well, isn't the simple answer world revolution?
Yeah, too simple.
Yes.
I mean,
actually, Hamas has this, not Hamas, I'm so sorry I said it, Haaretz, uh-huh. One of the newspapers that is somewhat free in Israel, and they're threatening to shut it down because they voice opinions that are threatening to the ruling Jewish state ideology. There's an interesting article in there where they said there should be absolute right of return. There should be two states. People should be able to live in anywhere they want, and but they have to live under the rules of those states. You know, I mean, this is something that's completely kind of off the radar right now, completely on the back burner right now, because nobody's even thinking about this at this moment. But right up until this moment, there was practically a civil war in Israel over the collapse of democracy, over the collapse of and part of the opposition, that limits of the opposition, but they weren't dealing with the occupation as much as they should have, the whole question of occupation. But there was the reach for more total control over everything that goes on in the society on the part of Netanyahu and his ilk was pushing the society apart at the seams. And all
his judicial reforms were extremely unpopular and threatening the continuation of his administration or regime.
Right. You put it much better than I did. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was also empowering rabbis, I'm not sure, to be more involved in what would otherwise be the responsibility of secular courts to settle disputes. So I'm not well versed on that, all the details of that, but that's what I've read in an article in the New York Times, I think. But it is striking to me that the Western left has not targeted Netanyahu particularly in its protests, and that there isn't an attempt to reach to leftists in Palestine and Israel both to try to form a movement of solidarity and, you know, a one-state solution perhaps, where Palestinians and Israelis would both have, you know, full suffrage, the same rights to own land, the same rights to mobility, and it might be either amendments to or revision to or a new constitution for Israel. Nothing along those lines that would protect, because you already had people in civil society in Israel very upset about the loss of their rights and the protection from the executive. But I'm surprised that the Western left hasn't picked this up as a way to move from slogans and simple calls like for ceasefire or defunding Israel to actually trying to be politically involved.
I think there are groups, Arab and Israeli groups, that work together consciously, trying to begin again with the non-demonizing of the other and to recognizing their mutual humanity. There are those seeds and groups that, you know, have consciously been trying to break down the rigidity of that political and social divide.
A lot of that starts with women. I mean, it's the Israeli and the Palestinian women who are very consciously coming together and saying, those are our sons, our children that are being slaughtered. And there are women in black started there, and there are other organizations specifically of women trying to reach that.
Tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets across Israel to protest Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial overhaul. The plan includes giving parliament control over judicial appointments. It would also grant the legislature power to overturn Supreme Court decisions. We're lucky to bring in Martin Indyk. He is a Lowy Distinguished Fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and twice U.S. Ambassador to Israel. How big of a deal is this? We know about the protests. We know that people use the term civil war. In your estimation, how big of a departure is this?
It's highly unusual. There have been large-scale demonstrations in Israel before, but you have to go back decades to find some precedent for it. And this looks much more like a full-scale civil society revolt, because you've got it across all sectors, particularly the private sector, the high-tech entrepreneurs who are moving their money out of Israel.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.